This is your life, episode 73. Hello and welcome to this episode of This Is Your Life. My name is Michael Hyatt and this is the podcast dedicated to intentional leadership. My goal is to help you live with more passion, work with greater focus, and lead with extraordinary influence. In this episode, I'll be talking about advice to new CEOs or those who want to be CEOs. And I thought about broadening this to all kinds of leaders, but I felt like I was going to dilute it if I did so. So this is really focused on CEOs or those who want to be, but it would apply equally if you're an entrepreneur or a small business owner or the head of a company. But I really, really think I've got some advice that you're going to find helpful. But first, this podcast is brought to you by Platform University, an online membership site for helping you launch your personal platform or take it to the next level. You can find out more at platformuniversity.com. And by the way, if you're already a member, make sure you tune into our live Q&A call tomorrow night. We'll be discussing how to be generous with your content and your audience. And specifically, we'll be talking about the secret to knowing what to sell and what to give away. I get that question a lot. Strategies to transition from an all-free model of content to offering paid products without alienating your audience or feeling schmarmy about it. And we're going to talk about how to use generosity to grow your traffic and your connection with other platform builders. So you can join us on Thursday, November the 21st at 9 p.m. Eastern or 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. And you can find out the details inside the membership at platformuniversity.com. This is a members-only call, but it's not too late to join. You could join today. It's only $30 a month. And if you find that it's not helpful, you can cancel your membership at any time. But we have about a 92% retention because our members love what they're getting inside of platformuniversity.com. Well, this past week was kind of interesting. I had cataract surgery, and you may be thinking, you're not old enough to have cataracts. And that's what I thought too when my optometrist was the first person to discover it. And he sent me to an ophthalmologist and they confirmed that, yes, I did have cataracts that were worth getting taken out. And I'm very, very nearsighted. I wear, at least I did up until the surgery, -8 contact lens, which tells you a little bit about how blind I am. And it's really difficult for me to see anything very far away. And so as a result of that, I developed cataracts earlier than the general population. And my doctor said I now qualified to have them taken out. And the cool thing was that they were going to be replaced. You know, cataracts are a disease that affects the lens of your eye and it just clouds it. So you're like looking through a dirty windshield almost. And so I went to a doctor who removed my right cataract, my right lens, and replaced it with a lens that enables me to see crystal clear. And I had it tested the day after and at 20/20. Really cool. But it reminded me, and of course, this is the liability of being a blogger and a podcaster. You know, you're trying to always redeem whatever experience you're in and draw lessons from it. And this one, I thought there's got to be a lesson in this. This is just too big. You know, it's vision, it's my eyesight and all of that. And as I was getting ready for work this morning, I thought, you know, the vision is so dramatic between my left eye, which is still uncorrected, and my right eye, which has the new lens in it. And somebody asked me at church yesterday, well, what's the difference? Well, a couple things. One is the vision's a lot better. It's totally corrected now in the right eye. 20/20. We'll see if it remains that sharp as time goes on. But right now it's 20/20. But more importantly, the colors are unbelievable. If I put my hand over my left eye and look just out of my right eye, the colors, especially whites, bright white, colors are vibrant. If I hold my hand over my right eye, which is the new lens, and look out of my old lens, the left eye with a contact lens on, then the colors are just really dingy. especially whites, are kind of yellow or brownish. Obviously, I never noticed this before because I didn't have anything to compare it to. But now that I've got something to compare it to, oh my gosh, the vision is unbelievable. But it made me wonder, how many things are we looking at life, assuming that they're reality because we don't have any basis of comparison, and we assume that our perception equals reality? And I'm probably going to write a blog post on this, but just as I was thinking about it this morning, I thought, you know, it's so easy to mistake that, to think, well, that's just the way that things are in my business, or that's the way things are in our industry, or that's the way things are in our economy. But there are always these disruptive forces that come in. They may be external, they may be internal, but there's these disruptive forces that don't assume that perception equals reality, and they realize that things could be very different. And those are the people that tend to lead, that tend to be successful. And so it was another reminder to me that I need to be very careful about my assumptions. Are they reality, the way things really are out there, or are they just my perception of how reality is? And I would ask you the same question. In your company, in your industry, in your own life, what's your own capability or your resources are? Apply it to everything. Question everything and ask, is this reality or is this just my perception of reality? So with that, let's get into our content for today. Advice to new CEOs or those who want to be. I was the CEO of Thomas Nelson Publishers for 6 years, and it was awesome. I had a great experience. It was one of the most difficult things I ever did. I had no idea that when I assumed that role that I would be facing the recession 2 years after I got into the role. But nonetheless, I learned so much about leadership. I learned so much about myself, both what my capabilities are and what some of my limitations were, but I learned a ton. And when I stepped down from that role to speak and write full time, which had always been my dream, and to be an entrepreneur, I had several people ask me, okay, knowing what you know now, and if you were looking back, what would you advise yourself back when you were just starting out as a baby CEO? And I got to thinking about that. I even wrote a blog post on it, but I want to share those thoughts with you today. And this is a great question. And what I'd like to offer you in this podcast, in this episode, are 7 truths. And I think they're applicable not only, as I said at the top of the show, to CEOs, but those who aspire to be, those who are small business owners, those who are entrepreneurs, but those who are, you know, maybe it's just you're leading a division or you're leading a franchise or you're leading, you know, some office, but you're in a position of significant leadership. These are truths that I think will help you. Truth number one, your position is a role, not your identity. Now, I learned this in a really graphic or dramatic way when a friend of mine stepped down as the CEO of his company. And he asked me a day later, he said, look, this was really a telling moment. He said, if I'm not the CEO, who am I? Wow. I mean, this is one of those things that you need to have figured out long before you assume your role as the CEO or step down from the role as a CEO. But who are you independent of your work? What's your identity? Your title is not who you are. Your title represents one aspect of your life, not the whole of it. And I think it's easy to get this title idea, this label idea, confused with our identity. You know, I see this in couples. They get older, their kids leave the house, and their identity has been as a mom or as a dad. And I see this particularly with women. And it's like, gosh, the kids are gone. They're grown. They've left my home. Do I have any identity? Do I really matter? What's my role in life now? Because everything seems to have shifted because I'm no longer the mother of small children or the mother of teenagers or whatever it may be. But your position is a role. It's not your identity. Truth number two, your position is temporary, not permanent. You know, according to numerous studies, the average tenure of a CEO right now is 5 to 6 years. So I lasted about the average length. I mean, that's partly because it's so stinking stressful. It requires so much. And every few years, you need somebody to come in with a different frame of mind that's got the energy to really attack it. It doesn't have to be that way. My predecessor, Sam Moore, was the CEO of Thomas Nelson for 50 years, which is amazing. I mean, That is longer than the typical career of most people, but he was the CEO for 50 years. But it's more than that. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average worker stays in each of his or her jobs 4.4 years. Get this, 91% of millennials born between 1977 and 1997, that's the definition of a millennial, 91% of millennials expect to stay in a job for less than 3 years. So the bottom line is that you'll likely have 8 to 15 jobs over the course of your career. Now, you may think that your tenure as the CEO or your tenure as a business owner or your tenure as a leader at your division, whatever it is, may last forever, but it won't. It's going to come to an end. And those days of the long tenures, like Sam Moore at Thomas Nelson of 50 years, those days, I think, are pretty much gone. There's going to come a time when you will step down or step away, and you better embrace the fact and plan for it. It's going to create that very thing, will create the kind of urgency you need and the focus you need to succeed. So your position is temporary, not permanent. Truth number three, your position is a privilege, not a right. Now look, you've probably arrived at the spot you're in or the spot you hope to be in through a combination of talent, hard work, and timing. I get that. But that doesn't entitle you to anything. And if there's one thing that's plaguing our culture today, and it's not just an American phenomenon, but we see this all over the world now, but is this philosophy of entitlement. I deserve something. And sometimes it's they haven't even earned it. They don't have the talent or they don't have the timing. But I'm saying in your case, you've had all those, and that still doesn't entitle you to anything. Being a CEO, being a leader is an enormous privilege. It's a gift, and it's a gift that few people will ever know. You can't take it for granted. This is the most important thing. You've got to hold it with an open hand. And my view as a person of faith is that this is something that's been given to me by God, and I'm going to keep it open-handed. I'm not going to clutch it or grab it or try to hold on to it, but I'm going to embrace it, but with an open hand. Truth number four, your position is about faithfulness, not about achievement. Now, this is an important distinction because while faithfulness sometimes leads to achievement, it doesn't always. I came into my role as the CEO of Thomas Nelson with specific plans about what I wanted to achieve. You know, in retrospect, they were pretty grandiose. I mean, I had this unbelievable plan of everything that I wanted the company to be and to become. Well, then the Great Recession hit. And the story took a completely different turn. It wasn't something I planned on. It was far more significant than we anticipated, especially at the beginning. But the mission changed, and suddenly it became clear to me that being faithful in the midst of adversity and difficulty was the most important thing I could do. Yes, I wanted to grow. I wanted to accomplish the results our investors expected. But being faithful ultimately was my job. And I think if you hold that position that you have as that, it will steer you through a lot of confusing times when you might be tempted to achieve at the expense of some of your principles. So truth number four, your position is about faithfulness, not achievement. Truth number five, your position is about them, not you. Now, the world has enough narcissistic leaders, right? It doesn't need one more. And being a CEO is not about you. It's about them, the people you've been called to serve. This is a completely different model of leadership than what I think the world offers in general, which is, you know, it's about you. Everybody else revolves around your world. You're the main actor in this story that you're telling yourself, but it's really not. It's about you serving the people that you're leading. And this includes your employees. It includes your customers, and it includes your investors. And yes, I put them in that specific order, and it's because of this. Happy employees make for happy customers. Happy customers make for happy investors, and happy investors make for happy CEOs. So truth number five, your position is about them, not you. Truth number six, your position is about stewardship, not ownership. I've really already said this, but let me just make the point even more clearly. Being a steward is different than being an owner. Now, As a person of faith, as a Christian, I believe that God owns it all. I'm merely a steward. Even if you own, quote, own your own business, you're still a steward. Based on that belief, CEOs, even if they don't believe in God, have an ultimate accountability to Him. And you hold what you hold on behalf of someone else, even if you're not a person of faith. Stay with me for just a minute. You hold what you have on behalf of someone else. If not God, then the board. If not the board, then perhaps their children. If not their children, then posterity. But this has been given to you as a gift, as a stewardship, and there's ultimately going to be an accountability. Somebody is counting on you to come through for them. So that's truth number six. Truth number seven, your position will require more than you can provide on your own. Man, I thought for years as I was moving toward becoming the CEO of Thomas Nelson, I mean, there were times when I felt inadequate and times I felt fearful, but sometimes I would get full of myself and I would think, oh, I've got what it takes. Or you often think this, you know, well, I could certainly do a better job than the guy who's the current resident, right? You know, he's making bad decisions or he's got bad judgment, or I would have done it differently, but you think I could do a better job. But your position is going to require more than you can possibly imagine. I felt inadequate really with every new promotion I've ever received, but none more than when I became the CEO of Thomas Nelson. Suddenly, I realized what it was like to sit in that chair, where the buck stops there, where I have sort of the ultimate accountability to the board. Well, other CEOs I know have expressed the same sentiment. They realize that they're responsible for the welfare of hundreds, perhaps thousands of employees and their families. And it can be overwhelming to realize that payroll's due on Friday. And if you don't pay your employees, they don't get to eat. And beyond that, pay their rent and send their kids to college and accomplish their dreams. They have dreams as well. But this healthy sense of inadequacy, in my view, is the very thing you need to remain humble, teachable, and open to counsel. You don't have all the answers. Just because you've been conferred a title as the CEO or the leader of that division doesn't suddenly, miraculously, make you the smartest person in the room. You know, it just means that you have a role of advancing the mission, of pointing the way, of trying to determine the destination. But if you're going to be successful, and particularly if it's a big goal, you're going to need the help of a lot of people, the people that are all around you. You don't have to be the smartest person in the room. You simply have to be like a symphony conductor. You've got to be able to conduct the symphony and call up the instruments and the parts as you need them. One last thing I would say to new CEOs, and I can't overemphasize this, take care of yourself. Make your spiritual, emotional, and physical health a priority. And here's why. During your tenure, you're going to experience more stress than you can imagine. I thought I'd been in stressful positions before. I thought I'd been under a lot of pressure. Oh my gosh, nothing like being a CEO. You need all the resources you can muster, and you're going to be tempted, trust me on this, you're going to be tempted to put yourself last. But if you die of a heart attack, if you blow out your marriage, if you burn out emotionally, if you lose your faith in God, you're going to be of little use to anyone. So you've got to exercise an appropriate level of self-care. And even in the midst of the recession, when things were ugly and the fur was flying and it was very difficult, I made sure that I practiced my morning routine, that I gave attention to my spiritual, my intellectual, my emotional, my physical growth. And I did what Dr. Covey used to talk about, which was to sharpen the saw. And that was a habit that I acquired long before I became the CEO. And I want to suggest to you, if you're aspiring to a position of leadership, particularly the role of a CEO or a business owner, you need to get those habits in place now. You might think you'll get the habits in place later when you get the position. You won't, because then it's going to be all hands on deck. And the things that you're going to tend to do are the things that have become by that point muscle memory. And if you don't have these baked into your character, you're going to flounder, you're going to struggle, and you'll never build those things into your life. So the time to do it is now. Well, here's a question for you. What advice would you give to new CEOs or those who are in a new position of leadership? Leave your comment at michaelhyatt.com/73. That's where the show notes are. That's where the comments are. And I would love to hear from you, because all of us together are smarter than any of us individually. I hope that's been helpful. I'll be back in a minute with our listener Q&A segment. Well, welcome back. Again, we had tons of questions this week, a couple as a follow-up to our last session on entrepreneurship, but the others are kind of all over the map, so I'm going to take them one at a time, and the first one is from Shelley.
Hi, Michael. My name is Shelley, and I am a garden blogger at sewandipity.com. I have been a longtime listener of your podcast, and I want to thank you for the little gems of wisdom I've picked up along the way. I've been enjoying your recent episodes with Gail and have a question concerning marriage and entrepreneurship. My husband and I have been together for 13 years and are both A-type personalities and entrepreneurs. I had a small business for 8 years in garden design, and my husband now runs our sporting goods store we started up about 5 years ago. In addition, my husband has played sports at a pro level for many years, and I've spent a good deal of our relationship cheering for him from the stands. No doubt about it, he has been a huge support to me in my ventures, but with the crash in the economy, I was forced to take on a job I am not fulfilled with while we struggle to get the retail store to become profitable. After 5 years of being the majority breadwinner in the relationship at a job I am not happy with, I find it difficult to be supportive in his ventures and would like to get back to pursuing my own dreams full-time as well. What advice would you give in a situation like this? Thank you and appreciate your answer and look forward to hearing it.
Thanks, Shelley. This is a tough situation to be in, I think. And I, you know, in my situation, I'm kind of the entrepreneur and Gail's been in that supportive role. And we're experiencing a little bit of that right now because she's at a place where she's been asking, you know, what is my dream? What are my talents? What do I need to express? And I've done my very best to support that. But I know that sometimes when you've got two entrepreneurs, two go-getters, so to speak, in the same relationship, it can be tough. And what I would recommend more than anything, and this is no magic bullet, but you've got to have a conversation. You know, you've got to be able to talk about this. You've got to be able to express your feelings in a safe environment where you feel validated. And if your husband is unwilling to do that or doesn't know how to do that, you know, I would really suggest that you get outside help. Gail and I did this several times in our marriage where we went for counseling. We went to seminars, we got outside resources that helped us become more effective as communicators. And there's still times when we have meltdowns or we get crosswise with one another, or one of us isn't listening or paying attention or doesn't assign the same priority as the other one does to it. And we just have to have, you know, a hard stop and sit down and have a tough conversation. But we're committed to that because we know that we have to speak the truth in love. That's one of the things that we're committed to as a couple. And we know that sometimes you have to go through some conflict to get to that next level of intimacy. And so we don't avoid conflict. And I think that can be a terrible thing for marriage when you feel like you're walking around on eggshells and you really can't bring up that, quote, forbidden topic because of the reaction that you might get on the part of your spouse. And I think you've got to get past that. And you may not be able to do that on your own. And that's where I would recommend counseling. And sometimes you just have to say, the parties just have to sit down and say, look, this is serious. And I need some help. I need your attention. We need to talk through this because this is headed for a train wreck if we don't deal with it. And I think you have to stand also for the outcome. It's not just about, you know, resolving the conflict, but it's really about the kind of a marriage you're trying to build, the kind of life you're trying to build, the quality of life you're trying to build, what you've been doing, being in a job that you don't particularly like for all these years. Sometimes that's necessary for a season, but it's not sustainable as a long-term strategy. And that's where you just have to talk about it because it's very easy to convince yourself that something is temporary when in fact it's becoming permanent. You've got to own up to that. You've got to admit it and you've got to talk it through. The next question comes from Alex.
Hey, Michael, this is Alex Barker from the Leadership Dojo podcast, and I'm really excited about this new episode for Advice for Young Leaders. One main reason, because I ask a lot of people on my podcast that question, what advice do you have for young leaders all over the world? And the advice I've received has been very thought-provoking just for me, but also for my listeners. And I'd love to hear your advice on what gap do you think exists for young leaders? What service, what thing do young leaders need that they are not getting right now in the marketplace? I'm really excited to hear what you have to say, but I'd also love to have you on my show on the Leadership Dojo. Some of your buddies have been on the show, like Dan Miller, and I'm releasing Jeff Goins' interview here pretty soon. So you can check out my website, leadershipdojopodcast.com. And thanks so much, Michael, for what you do.
Hey, Alex, thanks for your question. And yes, I'd love to be on your show. You can contact me and I'll get it worked out as a time to when we can do it. In terms of what do young leaders need that they're not getting in the marketplace, you know, this it's easy to focus on what's missing, but I want to just say that we live in the best time ever for leadership. There are more resources available. There are more books, more seminars, more conferences, more ways to network with other leaders than there have ever been before. I mean, when I was just starting out, there wasn't that much available. Maybe a few books, that was it. Leadership as a specialty, as a discipline, as a focus, really hadn't been articulated when I started out, so there weren't that many resources. But now we've got all this stuff that's out there, and probably that's also part of the problem, because people think if they read a book on leadership or they go to a seminar, suddenly they're qualified to be a leader. But where leadership really is worked out is on the job. And I would say the one thing that young leaders aren't getting is patience. They need the experience. They need the patience. They need to make sufficient number of mistakes to hone their leadership skills, more importantly, their character, because it's out of your character that your leadership flows. But I would say it's that, you know, that young leaders need to realize that they're not going to suddenly walk into a job because they've been given the title, they've attended a few courses, or they've read a few books, and suddenly now they're equipped to manage people. And I think we've seen that at the highest levels of government in the last few years of what happens when you put people into positions of leadership who don't have the experience. And it doesn't make them bad people. It just means that it's very difficult for them to lead in those situations because they don't really have enough failures as a leader under their belt. So that's what we need to embrace as leaders as well, as those failures and those mistakes, because those are the things that make us stronger and make us better leaders. Next question comes from Brent.
Hi, Michael. This is Brent from Columbus, Georgia, and I blog at leadright.wordpress.com. And my question is this. I'm very much a type A leader, and with regards to most things, I'm pretty much set in my ways because I have a system. My question is directed at the issue of productivity. I realize that my current methods work well, but if there's a better way to be productive that fits my personality and style, how do I find it? It's just finding those methods to consider that I'm having trouble with. Any help would be perfect and appreciated as always. Love your blog. Thanks.
Brent, I'm not sure I fully understand your question, but let me see if I can rephrase it and then I'll answer the question I think you're asking, which is how can I find ways to be more productive? It sounds like you're already a productive person, but you're always looking for ways to improve, ways that are more congruent with your personality, with your style, and so forth. You know, I will say this. For me, I don't get set in my ways either. I'm always looking for ways to improve, and whatever process I'm using now, I see as, you know, kind of the best solution to the situation now, but I'm wide open to changing it, wide open to using new software, using new methods, using new processes, because I want to be the most productive, the best version of myself that I can be. And it sounds like you do too. One of the best things you can do, I think, is to regularly expose yourself to productivity resources like Beyond the To-Do List with Eric Fisher. And you can find that podcast at beyondthetodolist.com. Terrific podcast where Eric is always exploring how to be more productive and how to find more meaning in life. And it's just a terrific podcast. Ray Edwards talks a lot about productivity's tools as well, and you can find him at rayedwards.com. A website that I've been reading for years and love is Lifehacker website, like lifehacker.com. You know, frankly, they've gotten into a lot of things unrelated to life hacking in recent years, but still, they're a terrific resource, and I always find practical tips there that I can use almost immediately. And then perhaps the granddaddy of all productivity websites is the GTD Times. This is David Allen's official website. And David Allen, as you probably know, is the author of the book, Getting Things Done, and really the founder of the whole GTD, as it's called, methodology. And this is the official website, GTD Times. He's not the only one that writes there, but there's always lots of helps in hacking your productivity. So hopefully that'll help. The next question comes from Mark.
Hello, Michael. My name is Mark Hust, and I blog at www.standingformore.com. It's about upholding our beliefs in faith, family, and finances while offering hope. I want to use the blog as a platform to continue blogging, writing some ebooks, and offering coaching someday. But the other night, my wife said to me that she could see us standing on a stage in front of an audience telling our story and hopefully reaching others to offer them hope in their marriage with our own story. I never thought about speaking before. What advice would you give to someone who's just starting to investigate this area and how to get started? I searched your website and saw the launch conference, but we are not sure if we can afford that at this stage of our life. I am an active duty member in the U.S. Coast Guard, and I want to use my time left in the service to build my platform. And it's exciting to think that my wife might want to be part of this journey. Any advice you have or resources you recommend will be greatly appreciated. Thank you for all that you do.
Mark, I would suggest first and foremost that you listen to great speakers and you ask yourself the question, what makes them a great speaker? You know, like one of the speakers that I love to listen to is Andy Stanley. I would, you know, if somebody pinned me down and said, who's your favorite public speaker? I would say Andy. And so I've listened to him. I'm always listening, applying what he's sharing because it's so powerful. But I'm also kind of listening with the other ear thinking, okay, how's he doing what he's doing? Another resource is listen to episode 87 of the Smart Passive Income podcast with Pat Flynn. This particular episode is Why You Belong on Stage, Pat's brain dump of public speaking and presentation tips. And that's the most recent episode as I'm doing this podcast of his podcast. But he talks about what he's learning kind of as a beginning speaker and somebody who aspires to be a professional. And he approaches it like somebody would who doesn't just kind of take it for granted. So he's really trying to learn it. He's trying to be thoughtful and intentional about it. And I think it will help you kind of frame where you go from here. Obviously, you can read books. A couple that I would recommend, The Secrets of Dynamic Communications, Prepare with Focus, Deliver with Clarity, Speak with Power by Ken Davis, my business partner in the Dynamic Communicators workshops and seminars. But that's a terrific book. I'll have a link in the show notes for you. Also, Communicating for a Change, 7 Keys to Irresistible Communication by Andy Stanley. That's kind of Andy's methodology and how he does what he does. I found both of those terrific. You can also take the online training that we offer at scoreconference.tv/online.html. And again, I'll have a link in the show notes so you don't have to remember all that. But the Score Conference, without question, and I'm a co-owner, so I'm biased, but without question, that's the most helpful public speaking resource that you can take advantage of. You just listen to our students, people like Cliff Ravenscraft, who's been to that, Ray Edwards, who's been to it, other people who have been to that conference and just rave about it. By the way, the Launch Conference is a conference for public speakers, but it's on the business of public speaking. I personally wouldn't make that a priority for you right now, but I would make a priority, even if you have to save your nickels to come, to the Score Conference, because the content that we share with you there will shape everything you do in terms of communication, writing, speaking, podcasting, if you get into that, even writing emails or making proposals. I use the Score methodology every day, and you can find out more about the conference at scoreconference.tv. We've got one coming up in Orlando in the spring of 2014 will be our next one. This is something we try to do twice a year. The next question and the final question comes from Scott.
Hey, Michael, this is Scott Eblen. Thanks for the topic on advice to new leaders. My question for you is, a lot of leaders are promoted into their roles after they've already been working with team members who were previously peers. But once the individual is promoted to a leadership role, those former peers are now the folks on that leader's team. That can be a really awkward situation for the new leader and a difficult situation to navigate. I would love to hear your advice to new leaders who find themselves leading folks who were formerly their peers on the team, And now that new leader is the leader of those former peers. Thanks a lot. Looking forward to hearing your answer.
Yeah, this happens frequently. In fact, I would say this is the norm. It certainly happened to me in every role where I've been promoted. I was suddenly the boss of people who had been my peers. And that can be awkward. But listen, one of the things that makes you effective as a leader is to speak the truth, to hit issues head on, and to call them out. It doesn't do anybody any good to kind of dance around them or sweep them under the rug. I know I'm mixing my metaphors here, but it doesn't do any good to not address them. So you've got to address it. And I think one of the first conversations that you have to have as a new leader with your former peers is, look, I'm the new leader. Here's what that means. I fully realize that we were peers together, but now something has changed. Let me tell you what's not going to change, and let me tell you what will change. And I would be very clear about that. And you're going to have to adjust your behavior some. You know, I think if you'll see yourself as the servant, as their servant, and trying to make them successful, it really helps with this, particularly if it's not just something you're paying lip service to, but something you're actually doing in your role, finding out how you can make them successful. But it is what it is. And I think to pretend that it doesn't exist or that you can manage around it without having a conversation, I think is not going to serve you or serve them. So you've got to speak into the situation, give people an opportunity to voice their concerns. The truth is, some of those people may have been passed over for the role. In other words, you got the job they wanted, and maybe they're struggling with it. And I would say that in those particular situations, you should call that person into your office and just address it head on. And I tell you, I had this situation too, where once I was promoted, there were people that I didn't want on the team, people I thought my boss should have let go or sent packing. And now it was my job, because I didn't frankly want them on my team. I had to make those tough decisions. Well, the sooner you can make those decisions, the better. You know, people expect when a new leader comes into power that there's going to be change. You have a window of opportunity to affect change, affect big change. People aren't surprised when it happens. There will be people that will come to you and say, you know, I don't know why your predecessor didn't do this, but good for you for getting it done. Finally, you know, somebody had the guts to make the decision that all of us have seen for so long. I got that response when I let go a couple of guys that I had worked with, but now I was suddenly managing. So have the guts, and this is what so much of leadership is about, is courage to do it quickly in that window of opportunity that you have to make the change. Now, there's other people that just maybe aspire to the job. They're really team players. They're people that you want on the team, but they're just going through, you know, a sense of loss because they didn't get the promotion that they thought they should get. Maybe they feel like you're less qualified. I, again, would give voice to that and just say to the person who's feeling that way, look, I know you wanted this position. The truth is you're probably more qualified. I'm not quite sure why I got the position or whatever it is that's the truth. I wouldn't make something up or be disingenuous about this. But be honest about it and say, look, the truth is we're serving here together. I realize that this position is a position only. I don't pretend to be better than you or smarter than you. I need you to succeed. And call out from them what it is you need them to contribute to the team for the betterment of everyone and for the mission of the company or the ministry that you're leading. So I hope that helps. Do you have a question as you're listening to these questions? Does something else spark in your brain, or there's some other topic that you'd like to ask a question about? You can do that at michaelhyatt.com/podcast question. And I'll be back in a minute with some final announcements. Okay, three quick announcements. I talked about my speaking in the previous segment about the subject of public speaking, and I've ratcheted way back my public speaking. I did about 30 engagements in 2013. I'm actually done now for the rest of the year. Hooray. But I want to dial that back this next year to 10 engagements. All of those are filled with the exception of two right now. And if you've got an event that you'd like me to speak at that you think I might be an interesting presenter for your event or for your conference, I'd love to hear from you. You can find out more at michaelhyatt.com/speaking. Then I want to talk about WordPress setup. If you're trying to build a platform, if you've got a message, a cause, a product, a service, something you believe in that you're trying to get out to the world, You no doubt realize by now that it's very noisy. It's very cluttered. It's hard to get your message out. What you need is a platform. I talk about that in my book, Platform Get Noticed in a Noisy World. But job number one is to set up a blog, something that gives you the opportunity to express your message, to share your content, to share your wisdom, your expertise with the world. And there's no better way to do that than on the WordPress platform. And I've got a step-by-step screencast tutorial at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress setup. You can set up your very own self-hosted WordPress blog in 20 minutes or less. And I've got a Bluehost special discount in that screencast for only $3.95 a month. In other words, their normal cost is $4.95 a month, but with the affiliate code that's in that screencast, you can get it for $3.95 a month. So check it out. Again, it's at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress setup. There's also a link in the show notes. Third announcement is that my next podcast is going to be on 13 ways to frustrate those you lead. This is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I want to talk about the ways that leaders frustrate their followers and how not to be that guy or that gal that's constantly frustrating the very people that you're trying to lead because it gets in the way. And we'll talk about that in the next episode. Well, that's it for this episode of This Is Your Life. You can find the show notes again at michaelhyatt.com/73, as in episode 73. And if you've enjoyed this episode and enjoying my podcast, please show the love by going to michaelhyatt.com/love. That'll make it very simple to share a pre-populated Twitter post, or you can modify it or do whatever you want. But I'd love for you to share that with your followers. You can also rate my podcast on iTunes. If you take a few minutes to do that, that would be hugely helpful in getting the visibility of the show up to those who haven't discovered it yet. But until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Now go make it count. This is your life. Are you who you wanna be? This is your life.